Okay, let's try this.
All right.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for the next 45 minutes. This is another in our ongoing series, the Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with a mover and shaker in the entertainment world. It is my very, very great pleasure to announce today's special guest. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's the co-founder of the platinum-selling bands Santana and Journey, Greg Rowley. To get everyone warmed up, let's sneak a listen to a track from his as-yet unreleased live DVD. This song should need no introduction whatsoever. Black Magic Woman. A new treatment to a very, very classic song. Greg, and welcome to the show.
How you doing, Simon? Good to be here.
Well, it's just wonderful that you could make time to talk to us. I have a little story for you. When your management folks shipped me the tracks for today's program, I played Black Magic Woman, and my wife, who's a huge fan of yours, whipped her head around and said, "I know who that is. Where'd you get that?" The expression on her face when I told her you were going to be a guest on the show was priceless. When did Black Magic Woman first chart?
Boy, I guess it would be 1970. That's when that came out. 69 was the first album, Santana. The second one was Abraxas, and it came out in 70. And so it had to be within that year anyway.
Right. I know that the vocal leads changed around a bit in Santana, but it was you on the original hit, I believe.
Yeah, I sang. I was the lead singer for Santana on the first three albums, four albums, including Caravanserai. And Carlos actually sang a song on Caravanserai, "Everything Is Coming Our Way." But other than that, he and I did "Evil Ways," where became a gang vocal. We just doubled up on it. But other than that, all the other stuff that wasn't gang vocals was me, and Black Magic Woman was one that I picked for the band. Took me about a year to talk them into it.
Hmm. Although, Black Magic Woman was a tremendous hit for Santana, but you weren't the first to record it. I do believe Fleetwood Mac beat you to the... beat to the punchline, shall we say.
Well, I actually found it from Fleetwood Mac, and the story behind that is basically Mike Shreve, the drummer from Santana, turned me on to the Fleetwood Mac album that was very blues-based, and I loved Peter Green's work based upon his involvement with John Mayall and the Bluesbreakers, where he took Eric Clapton's place on the following album, which was A Hard Road, which had the song Supernatural on it. It was just a gorgeous song. But his guitar work was just amazing to me. And so Mike knew that and said, you should listen to this. You'll love this. And I found Black Magic Woman on there, and it was written by Peter Green. And then I just knew I could sing it well. And, some songs are made for you, and some songs you just sing. And that one, in my estimation, was made for me. As a matter of fact, when I sang that song, it was one take, period. That was it. And that never happened. In fact, it's never happened since. We did two verses, and then something happened with the recording machine, and so it went down, and then I had to come back and sing the third verse after it was all wound up to do it. And sang that one time, and that was it. That's the take. That was one.
So let's fast forward 39 years. Tell me about this new live DVD that's coming out.
Well, it's based upon the band that I have now is based upon my roots with Santana. And the way that kind of came about, first of all, I was going to make an album, and it's called Roots Now. And at the time, I was trying to, steer it into being an acoustic album and all that. And I finally just started writing things and letting things just come out of me. And everything that came out was based on the Santana-esque music and percussion and some of it softer, some of it harder and all that. For the most part, that's what was coming out of me. Which is natural for me because it's what I was weaned on. It's where I started, and it's blues-based, and it's my roots, so that's it. So the band, Ron, my drummer, and I figured we should go put a band together. we're going to make this record. Let's go put a band together. And so we did. And that's what this is all based upon. And so the new music that's coming out from the Roots album, and also there's other new material that we've done since then, is part of this DVD, along with the hits from Santana that was that we did between the first album and the third album.
As I understand it, it was recorded at the Sturgis Bike Week.
Right.
That must have been quite the concert.
Yeah. Some Sturgis is a strange place. It's like, you know, there's women showing you things that you might not want to see, and but they are, those people have a ton of fun at doing what they do. And I mean, I don't know how many thousands of bikers there are, but it's quite an amazing thing. I mean, they've been doing it for years. People travel from all over the place to go to this. And we played with Steve Miller and I forget who else. It was Steve Miller and Cheap Trick and what's the other band? It was a couple of years ago. Can't remember.
Okay. Now, you have piqued my interest. You mentioned Steve Miller. Now, I have a DVD of a Steve Miller concert, and it might well have been from Sturgis. Who was the production company that did the video?
Coming Home Productions.
Yeah. What's the guy's name?
Jack Gullick.
You're right. Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty certain.
As a matter of fact, Jack is a terrific guy. They shot this with 17 cameras. They got shots of me I've never seen before, and I don't think I'll ever want to see again.
was this the one where they actually had a track, a camera mounted on a wire between the stage and something like a 100 yards back, and it was remote controlled.
You know what? I'm not sure. I really don't know that. Like I said, there was 17 of them, and some of them I thought they were going to give me a colonoscopy. So
I can't wait to see the DVD.
17 cameras is unruly. It's usually 11, 12. It's quite a bunch, and the guy to deal with this guy has just been tremendous. So, the band was on. The band played tremendously, and the music is what it is. And if you play it right, it's great, and we did.
When can we expect to actually see the DVD?
Well, it should be this time, sometime this year. I just finished, mixing the audio. And I just sent it out just a couple of days ago. So it's gone to video, and they've been editing, which with 17 cameras, they got a lot of work to do. And I mean, really, I saw the line cut, and the line cut was good enough for me. I mean, so I can't imagine. And these guys really know what they're doing. They've been doing this. They've done Madonna. They've done Smashing Pumpkins, they've done a bunch of
Yes, it is the same guy I spoke to.
Yeah.
I'm firmly convinced.
Yeah, it probably is.
As a reviewer, I have this urge to pigeonhole things, to put labels on bands, and I find it impossible to do with your music. There's so many elements in it.
Yeah,
there's Latin, there's rock, there's jazz, there's fusion. How do you view it?
You got it right. They gave it the name Latin rock ages ago, and because it was less print and easier to say, but it really doesn't explain it. The music that was made by Santana was made by six guys. And everybody had a hand in this. Carlos and I did the lion's work of writing arranging and stuff. But it could, I'm telling you now, it could not have been done had it been other people in the band to create this style of music. And everybody had a hand in it. And the music was the major thing in our lives, and that's where we focused all our energy. And we wanted to be we didn't want to be just a big San Francisco band. We wanted to be a big international band. That's what we shot for. You know, the whole point of that is, if you're going to shoot for anything, you might as well shoot for Mars, because you might make it to the moon, you know. So that's what we did. And the music itself was, it's blues, it's rock, it's Latin, it's jazz. We pulled things out. We played with the L.A. Philharmonic even. I mean, we did a bunch of things as very young guys, too.
Yeah.
You know, and street musicians for the most part.
Who is in the Greg Rowley band today?
The band I have right now is made up of some really world-class guys. I've got Mike Carabello is playing with me, who played with Santana. He's a conga player. And I've known him 40 years. And so that's why a lot of that percussion sounds so original. It's because it is. It's the way he plays. And the timbale player is Adrian Arias, who is Chepito's son, who is the original timbale player.
Wow.
He's a monster. He's totally amazing. He's just an amazing player. And a wonderful guy. He's like, it's great to have him in the band. The drummer is Ron Wixo, who's played with me in a band called The Storm. That's when I met him. 15 years ago I met him. And Ron and I started this whole thing. In fact, I've always been saying it's Ron's fault, because I was in a hammock at the time. I thought I was through. And we started recording, and here I am doing this stuff again. But I'm really enjoying it. Alfonso Johnson on bass, world-class bass player who played with Weather Report. And the list is so long, I can't go through it. But he also was a Santana alumni, and actually played with Santana longer than I did after I was gone. And the keyboard player is Wally Minko, who played with Jean-Luc Ponty and a host of others as well. And he's the one that does all the horn work and he's a jack of all trades, and he is an amazing player as well. And then the guitar player is Kurt Griffey, who was virtually unknown. And in fact, the story on Kurt was Ron played with him in a band that was made up of various people from various bands, from Steppenwolf to the Eagles to... you name it. I mean, there was just a million guys. And so they played everybody else's music, and Ron told me, he goes, well, Kurt could probably, you know, I know he could do the signature lines. I haven't heard him blow or anything. And so he comes in, and he turns out to be the shredder, and Ron looks at me like, I didn't know he could do this. Kurt Griffey takes this music to another place. He actually does little hammer things that you would see in heavy metal, but it does not. It's not out of place. It's not, and we laugh about it, but it's like he's an amazing player. He's grasped the guitar work of Carlos and Neil Sean, put it together, and did his own take on it, and has made it his own. And he is a tremendous player. I've been surrounded by great guitarists. I can tell you.
Okay, I'll tell you what. Seeing as you've talked about all of these great people, I think it's time to listen to them. It's a classic. Oi como va? So let's cue that up.
We'll see you next time.
Great stuff. The
pretty alive, huh?
Yeah. Oh, it certainly is. But as I understand it, the Sturgis DVD isn't the only thing happening. I understand there's a PBS program coming up that you're going to be featured on, and I also got wind that Warner Home Video are producing the ultimate collector's edition of Woodstock 3 Days of Peace and Music that's going to be featuring some extra footage of Santana's great performance.
Yeah, it's true. As a matter of fact, I live out here in Texas, in Austin. There's South by Southwest, and I'm going to be on a panel along with Mike Shreve to promote that. And you know, we worked hard on mixing. I think it is Evil Ways that they added. We actually were looking at Evil Ways and Persuasion, and Evil Ways got added to the mix, and that was all politics and business. But anyway, so I'm going to be doing that, and I may do that in June as well in New York. They were talking about doing the same sort of thing. And as far as the PBS special goes, the PBS is like, it's like a one of their fundraisers, and it's hosted by Trini Lopez from, you know, If I Had a Hammer, and can't think of them all. He had a few big hits, and some other Latin bands. El Chicano was in it, and of course my band, and it's that's slated to go out in March sometime.
I understand that you're pretty active touring. How many shows do you do in the average year?
At this point, we've been doing about 30. I'd like to get it to 40 or 50 and then decide whether I wanted to go back to 40 again. You know, my days of doing 9 months of touring are well over. I'm just not into doing that. I lived on the road for a good 13 years. So Journey being one of the toughest ones, we made that band, which I'm really proud of, but I mean, that's how that happened. We've toured 9 months out of the year, and I'm doing this because I love doing it. And the band I have is the guys are great. It's really, I guess, the best way to put it is, it really is. As you get older, you realize it's all about the hang. It's who you're with, and you know, the travel and the fun of it, instead of all the rest of it that takes you to what it takes to get there. So now it's like it's this cruise. The band is so good. I mean, we may not play for 6 weeks, and when we go to play, it's like falling off a log. And they're just great. The way I've been looking at it is, this is a band that tours steakhouses throughout the United States and Canada and Mexico, and and the following day we play music.
What a wonderful philosophy to have.
Well, it does. It kind of keeps it light, and that's why it's fun. I enjoy playing this to this day, all this music, and every night. And it's because of the guys that I play with. They're tremendous.
I guess the 70s and, to a certain extent, the 80s were my favorite period for rock music in general.
Uh-huh.
And I've interviewed quite a few musicians from this era, and I hear the same reoccurring themes, and there are two. Number one problem, business. The big labels had the bands under their thumb. You could have a double platinum album, a sold-out worldwide tour. You know, you were playing to 50,000 fans at every place you went. But at the end of the day, you were in the red with the label. You know, the business model was heavily stacked against the artist. What's your thoughts?
Well, as a matter of fact, it did turn into that, and it always is one of those things. Any business you get into, I'd like to, you know, spank my own industry for some of this stuff, but it's pretty much, that's the way business is. And so you either make a good deal going in, or you're going to have problems. And unfortunately, musicians, you know, when they get that brass ring, it comes with some hooks in it. And you got to get those hooks out before you get in. And a lot of guys don't. And what really killed it off, in my estimation, was when video became part of the deal. Most guys, you'd had to have a great video. This is in the 80s. You had to have a great video, and it was costly. And you know, the label, of course, wants to take that out of your royalties. And you know, and you're making a smaller chunk of change. But that's the marketing tool, and that's the contract, and that's the way they decided to do business. And you know, that's the way it was. And things changed after that. And so during the 80s, a lot of guys, they made a lot of quick dollars, but at the end product, you know, it wouldn't last. And in fact, the industry hasn't lasted. They should have embraced the internet. They did not. And they should have worked out deals way ahead of time and realized that there was no stopping this. But, you know, they tried to control it instead, and that's kind of what happened. I mean, that's the short version. So the musicians did kind of take it on the chin, but at the same time, you know, you've got to look out for your business and take heed and have a good manager. I had a the journey manager, Herbie Herbert. I can't say enough about. He was way hip to this stuff and way ahead of the game and through the 80s. And 90s, and is hip to what's going on now with the internet, and young people now are, in my estimation, are looking for the same thing that we were looking for in the 60s, where you want to hear all kinds of music and different music, and instead of pigeonholing everything, and so they go searching for music everywhere, and the internet opened up the floodgates, and that's kind of where it's gone. So now it's, you know, how many of them can play live of these bands, though? I don't know.
That's a very good answer. The number two problem, drugs and booze. I can honestly say...
I got a quick answer for that one.
I don't recall you getting caught up in that scene.
No, you know, the answer to all of that for anybody is like, man, I don't have a drug or booze problem. I have a police problem. You know, everybody got caught up in that stuff, and it's just a matter of degree and how bad it was. And, you know, we escaped it a lot. That's true. And at the same time, everybody did their share. So, you know, but we made it through, and I'm, you know, I still can remember things. It's great.
you were talking about the internet. Is it the musician's best friend or its worst enemy?
Well,
on the one hand, it gives you access to fans. On the other hand, there's this whole question of music piracy.
Yeah, and it's an interesting dilemma, because what's kind of happened here because of the piracy, but you know, that's kind of, it's kind of going away, and it's more fair for the individual listening to music, because they can pick and choose. What was happening prior to the internet was labels, I believe, were putting out CDs and charging an arm and a leg for it because the best way it could go. And on these CDs, there was only a couple of two or three good songs, and the rest of it just wasn't that great. Except for, of course, there are artists that did. But for the most part, it's kind of the widespread thing. And like anything, if you develop a business that you're not taking care of the people that are buying it, pretty soon they're going to leave and go somewhere else. And so they found ways of getting this music that they wanted, amongst other things, and the whole thing just, you know, springboarded into what it is now. And it's harder to do business, and at the same time, yeah, you do, you can get your name out there, and blogging is a great way of going. I don't know all of the ins and outs of this. I'm just going to play live myself. But in looking at it, it has opened up doors that weren't open for people that had no way to get anywhere. Because if a band sent a tape in or a CD of their music to a label to be heard, or had it sent in by a manager, and this, chances are, you know, 99% of them end up in a circular file. So they do. They don't even listen to them. It's like, I don't know how they get it done. I mean, I just don't know. And so that the internet opened up the doors so that people could actually get their music out there and be heard and seen, and people can make comment on it or whatever. And that helped a lot of bands. There's a lot of bands that got started out of the internet, and rightfully so. But their music was good, and you know, and timely, and all of that. As far as classic music goes, the problem with it really was piracy. On the older front, you know, piracy. It's like, this is how we make our living. I'll put it to you this way. I was listening to Howard Stern one day, which I don't do often, but I listened to him in the morning, and he had some college student on, and this is years ago when this first started up, when Napster was the big deal. And he had this college student on there, and the guy actually said, well, the music should be free because, you know, I paid for my internet connection. What? And Howard Stern's reaction was, he hung up on the guy and says, "Oh, there's a moron, and he's going to college." So the point being is, like, this is how we make a living. That would be unfair to think that you could get an intellectual property such as music and just get it for free. I don't think anybody should be, you know, beat to death with a price for music, but at the same time, everybody's got to eat. So that's kind of what happened when it started out. And then it opened up a whole new way of doing business. So it's good and bad. It's kind of, we'll have to wait and see how it ends up. But here we are talking on the internet, and how many people are we hitting?
I don't know.
Yeah.
But
there's access. Somebody can, you know. And that's great.
Turning back to the internet for a second, I actually put out a little treatise about this upcoming interview with you, and I invited some of our readers to send me questions, and so I don't want to dwell on this very long, but I'd love to get a couple of their questions in front of you.
Sure.
When did you start playing the Hammond organ, and when did you learn your playing techniques for organs and Leslie speakers?
It really started just prior to Santana, and I was in a band in San Francisco called William Penn and his Pals, which was a takeoff on Paul Revere and the Raiders, and that's when I realized, I really don't play other people's music very well, and so I need to do something else. And I hooked up with Carlos, 1966 or something, and realized that the kind of music that we were going to play didn't require a Vox organ. It required a Hammond, and I always liked the Hammond since I was 10 or 11 when I heard Jimmy Smith Walk on the Wild Side on AM radio, because that's all there was. And I didn't even know what a Hammond organ was, but I loved that song, and I loved the way that sounded, and that was it. And so playing blues and things of that nature, it needed that depth. And so I got a Hammond B3, and I spent 3 months just with about 7 Jimmy Smith records and picked out all the blues licks I could off of this guy, because he was the king of it, and started to develop my own idea about how to play this instrument. It was kind of like the first synthesizer to rock and roll. I didn't play it completely like jazz. And I didn't pick up on the jazz stuff that he did either. I enjoyed it, but I didn't. That's not where I was going. So I went to the blues bass thing, and then getting with Santana with percussion, it just kind of started to develop. And listening to guitar players, I developed ways of playing that nobody played on a keyboard.
I'm going to have to interrupt just for a second.
Sure.
Unfortunately, our show started a little late this afternoon, which means we're going to lose our live listeners in about 45 seconds. But fear not, listeners. If you go to www.bloggernews.net, in about an hour or so, I will have a link up to the full recording, and you can guarantee that the entire recording will be available. Okay, sorry about that. I had to intervene.
Sure.
The Hammond organ, the B3. This is my question, not someone else's. Do you use the classic version or the new B3 that came out in, I think, 2002?
Mine's got to be about 30, 40 years old. It's the one I played at the end of Santana. It's a cut down model. They took the innards of it, done by Bill Baird out of L.A., who has since passed away. But he designed this whole thing of a cut-down B3 that had it's a B3, and it is so good. It's a real even-sounding. It's a great organ, and I've had it for years. And it's, the old stuff is the best stuff.
I'm in. Inclined to agree with you. I interviewed Keith Emerson a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
He still has the original Moog synthesizer.
I just got rid of mine a little while ago. I sold it to a keyboard player for Steve Miller. He wanted it, and I said, "All right, you can have it." I had it for years.
Oh, no, I mean, we're talking about the modular Moog.
Oh, that one.
Yeah.
Oh, man, mine was a mini Moog. Oh, wow. The original Moog.
Yeah, he has it in a studio in L.A., and he even has a guy that's his whole mission in life is just to look after this thing.
it was an incredible thing. I just couldn't get past it. I tried fooling around with one of those, and I think Keith Emerson was the only guy that ever got any kind of music out of it that I know of. It was a bunch of noise and bleeps and oscilloscopes. I couldn't wrap my head around it.
I think it was probably way beyond most regular folks. But, Keith's a little different.
Yeah.
The other question that our callers had was, what was the most memorable tour date you've ever played? And do you have any funny or interesting stories that happened on tour or during a show? I'm pretty certain you could write a book about that.
Yeah, the one that most people would probably ask me about would be Woodstock in the first place, and it was an amazing thing because it was destined to be only, they thought they might have 30,000 people there or something, and it turns out to be 500,000 from all over the world, and peaceful and great and 4 days of music and. It was just incredible. And we flew into it because they parked on the highways. You couldn't drive to the gig. And so, they had to rent helicopters. The whole thing changed for this guy, Lang, and became, the grandfather of all videos and all of it. It's just an amazing thing that we were a part of that. It was just tremendous.
As you can probably tell, I wasn't born in the U.S.
No. I thought you were from Wisconsin.
Right. I spent the 70s in England and the 80s here in the U.S. I always think of the late 70s as the dark ages of modern music. Two things happened. Punk and disco arrived, and radio stations started consolidating playlists. Classic rock was out, Johnny Rotten was in. What are your memories of that period? Did it affect you?
There was a lot of things that were strange about that. I mean, I quit Journey in late 80, and so... I stopped playing music for a couple of years completely. I just stopped, and all this stuff started to happen, and MTV came out, which I thought was tremendous. But the music that changed was just not very good. It just wasn't very good. I understand the energy and I understand the point and all that stuff, but it just wasn't very good. And coming from where I came from, we were trying to compete with. When I was with Carlos and the guys, we were trying to compete with great jazz players, and I mean we were far from it, but that was the outlook. And this was more of an energy of thrashing, and some of the songs were great, some of them were horrible, and the bands, for the most part, just weren't very good. They just didn't play well, and it's not where I came from. So I was kind of wow, but people loved it. If people love it, it's like, I'm wrong. in this business, you're wrong. If you don't like it, but it's working and people do, well, then you're probably wrong about it. And you got to figure out what the game is at the time. And it doesn't mean you have to change into what they're doing, but I just didn't get that stuff.
I hate to do this. Because I've had so much fun talking to you, but our time is basically coming to an end. What I would like to do is thank you very, very, very much for taking part, and we're going to leave today's show with another track, and one that everyone will recognize, Gypsy Queen. Greg, it has been wonderful. Thank you so much for talking to us.
My pleasure, Simon.
Okay, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a wonderful day, and please check back at www.bloggernews.net. We always have lots and lots of great articles and great interviews. Have a super day. This is Simon Barrett giving you Gypsy Queen. Greg, thank you so much for
taking
part. And I do hope we can talk again sometime.
Yeah, well, I'll be around.
Okay.
All right, buddy.
You have a great day.
Okay.
Okay, goodbye.
Take care. Bye.